a gentleman who has really done so many things in the world of music and had so many great experiences playing with different bands, whether it be Ides of March, whether it be the most famous band that he formed, Survivor, whether it be any of the other work that he has done as a songwriter for various entities. I had joked about this with our FDH New York Bureau, who booked him for the program here tonight. I said, anybody that's written songs for 38 Special and Leonard Skinner is a friend of mine, and that would, of course, be Jim Peterik. Good to have you on the show here tonight, Jim. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on, man.
Oh, big pleasure. You're actually the second guy that we've had on from Survivor. We've had, of course, your longtime bandmate Jimmy Jameson on previously. It was a pleasure to talk to him, and you guys really, among other things in your varied careers, you managed to do something. I mean, very few people happen to get a chance to be part of one of the biggest bands of the decade. But as somebody that grew up in the '80s, I can tell you that's exactly what you were.
Oh, man, thank you. And I don't want to sound ignorant, but am I talking to Steve right now?
This is Rick Morris, yeah. Steve actually got you booked here for tonight, and we're very appreciative to him for doing so.
But, okay, I'm sorry, Rick.
No problem. No problem. We're just glad to get you on. We wanted to talk to you both about your own career and get some perspectives on that. And Steve, actually, to come back to him, because he had brainstormed this and deserves all the credit for making it happen, for booking you, conceptualizing it, whatever. We will get into this a little bit later with you as well. Want to get your thoughts as somebody who's really done some substantive things in the music business, your thoughts on the passing 30 years to the date tomorrow of John Lennon. So we certainly want to get your perspectives on that and what your thoughts and feelings were on that after we get a chance to talk about your own career here. But I'm very intrigued by the different genres really that you've worked with here, because when you get into working with a group like Chase, I mean, that's obviously very much different than anything like the aforementioned Skinner, 38 Special, Cheap Trick. So, you know, your work as a singer-songwriter has really kind of spanned a number of genres.
Well, you're right, Rick, and the common denominator to me is a great song, or hopefully a good song, but hopefully a great song. And that spans all the genres, whether the stuff I did with Chase or 38 Special, Survivor, Ides of March. The coin of the realm is, a message. You know, I love, a story, whether it's like Hold On Loosely or The Search Is Over. I love a great melody, and I like a good beat. You know, with those elements, I don't care if it's country or horn rock or heavy metal or, what they call melodic rock. It all comes down to a song.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've shown, as we said, a lot of varied ability as far as being able to put them out there as well. I know from doing some research on you as well that you also toured, I mean, I'm guessing in kind of a standard backup capacity, but with Heart and Boston. And talk about what it was like to be a part for only a time of groups like that.
Well, even before that wave, you're talking 1970 when Ides of March had our hit called Vehicle, which, we were all freshmen in college, and I was 19 years old when I sang Vehicle. And 1970 was a great year to have a hit record, because suddenly we were on the road with the likes of the Allman Brothers, Led Zeppelin, Janis Joplin, Grateful Dead, Poco, Rhinoceros, Youngbloods, Iron Butterfly. It was just an incredible summer to have a top 10 record. And, I mean, we're fairly unaffected by it all. I mean, we took it in, but we never got jaded and we never got big heads about it. I think our upbringing, kept us humble and kept us modest. But it was just a real thrill, and of course that rubbed off on me, opening up for a group like Led Zeppelin or Jimi Hendrix. You feel that power, and that stays in your mind. So, when I was putting together Survivor, of course I have all these memories and all these feelings of 10 years prior to that. And then, of course, Survivor happened, and then we were on the next wave with groups like Triumph and Iron Speedwagon, Bryan Adams, on and on. So, and Heart, of course. Just great times.
Now, ultimately, as that happened and as Survivor had the big breakout there in the 80s, and it really did seem to be a band that was very well suited to the time. So I have the sense, at least from the outside looking in, that something would have popped in a pretty big way with that regardless. But how central in your mind was the whole thing with the Rocky III movie, with Sylvester Stallone getting you guys involved with Eye of the Tiger? How central was that to you guys just blowing up and really making it big?
Well, you know, I can't say enough about how important Eye of the Tiger and the whole Rocky III thing was to the band. However, I got to say that we were kind of a faceless band at that entity, and we were labeled as Stallone's band. And in fact, there was a rampant rumor that Frank Stallone was actually the writer and singer of that song, which we hated that rumor because it was all us, and Stallone commissioned us to write it. In other words, we had not yet, you know, cut our teeth as a band. I think it took until Vital Signs, when we could stand apart from the Rocky image, to really make our bones as a rock band.
Well, then it must have been kind of a double-edged sword for a period of time there, because certainly in the very early days when he broke out in the WWF in 1984, I know that Hulk Hogan was using Eye of the Tiger as his entrance, and that's before I think some of the legalities and royalties and all that come into play. And next thing you know, he's got his own song commissioned by their house band. But for a period of time, he was using that. He was amplifying it to pretty great heights as he was becoming a mainstream celebrity himself. I guess that was just continuity from the Rocky movie where the song was associated and where he played a role. But was that kind of a double-edged sword as far as being able to break away from that Stallone image?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, like I said, it really took till Vital.
Hello, Jim? Jim, yeah, I think he dropped. All right. We'll work to get him back on here. Jim Peterick, founder and guitarist for Survivor, in the midst of a pretty good conversation with him here, so we'll work to get him back on the phone lines, talking about everything that had encompassed the big breakout of Survivor back in the period of 82, 83, 84 with the Rocky III movie and everything that happened. And I believe that was quick. I think we got him back. Okay, yeah, Jim, all right, pick up your thought as best you can there, my man, on everything that was going on with the use of Eye of the Tiger in the WWF and subsequently how you guys were able to break away from the Stallone image.
Right, I'm so sorry about
no problem.
The cell phone, but hopefully that won't happen again.
Sure.
But really, you know, Stallone paved the way, you know, for Vital Signs. And we really, well, obviously we changed singers between Stallone days and the Vital Signs days. Dave Bickler, who sang Eye of the Tiger, left the band, was having throat problems. And at that point, we go, what do we do now? And we made that very difficult transition with a new singer named Jimmy Jameson. And we auditioned many people. And when Jimmy auditioned, we go, gee, that's it. The search is over, no pun intended. he was just an amazing voice. And very few bands can withstand the change of a lead singer. It's happened maybe two or three times in rock where it actually survives. But JMO came over and gave the band a whole new life, and suddenly, you know, we had The Searches Over, High on You, I Can't Hold Back, First Night, and we had basically four hits from the Vital Signs record, and suddenly we were a band, not just Stallone's band.
Yeah, and I think that became apparent really with the string of hits during the decade there, and that was something that if people didn't get that at first, clearly they did over a period of time. Something I have in one of my notes from our producer Steve Servillo, I hadn't seen this anywhere in the research on you, but he had unearthed so you have had some strong involvement with the songwriting for Dummies series.
Yeah, I'm part of that whole Dummies series. I wrote, well, actually co-wrote Songwriting for Dummies, which has been a huge franchise. Of course, you can find it worldwide. We had Volume 1, which came out in 2002, and then they just asked us recently for an update, and that just came out about 2 months ago. And we've sold almost 250,000 books worldwide, just, you know, and it was a great opportunity, you know, to mass market many of my techniques for writing songs and the stories behind the songs. I've gotten tons of great feedback from young writers and old writers alike. I'd say the book helped them, so I'm very, very pumped about that.
Well, that's tremendous to be able to share the knowledge and really just kind of keep the chain of things going, and, you know, the thought of people being able to learn from your experiences and perspectives long after you're gone. That's really got to be pretty cool, pretty timeless. Another note that I got from Steve as well here, I believe, were you at and in any way a part of, I understand that Steve had helped do a little bit of networking to get a Chicago White Sox gig. Jimmy did a pregame show back during one of the games in May this year here, and he was fortunate enough to get to see it. Were you there for that as well? Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, that was a great opportunity. It was myself, Jimmy Jameson. Well, Jimmy was the spearhead, and it was myself and Kevin Chalfont and his keyboard player that did about a 20-25 minute set before the Sox game. Just tremendous. And, of course, we did the Usual Suspects, Eye of the Tiger, and I think we did Vehicle, just to throw that in there, and a couple other songs. But, you know, a stadium full of fans, that's a great feeling.
That's awesome. And, you know, Vehicle is such a great song, and just the use of it, and I can understand why it would be so highly desirable for commercial purposes, too. You know, it's one of those ones you just enjoy hearing whenever it comes on, even if it's just a snippet for that. And that's got to be a nice thing to be able to keep the, you know, the image of that song going as well for future generations.
Yeah, that's one of those evergreens. I never knew it when I was 18 when I wrote it. I wrote it for my girlfriend, who 38 years later is still my wife. But I'm trying to win her back, and I guess it worked. But, you know, I hear that song now, and I said, how could I have done that at age 19? I sound like a camel smoker of 35. But it was just a magical time.
It's awesome. I think of it like I think of a number of other tunes from around that time, and just timeless pieces of work here. As far as around that time, speaking of which, that would be about when the Beatles broke up, and there was about a 10-year period there before. While all four Beatles were walking the earth post Beatles period. So we wanted to get your perspective on this as somebody who's in the business, rather than necessarily just talk to somebody in the music media, which we're not averse to doing, but it's always interesting to get the perspectives of somebody who's kind of walked in the shoes with these musicians and really just felt the same kind of experiences, the same kind of triumphs and sorrows as far as the course of a career. First and foremost, to what extent were you, did you feel like you were influenced really by any of the Beatles? You came along right about at the tail end, I guess, of when they were together there. So, how did you look at them as somebody that was a singer-songwriter?
Well, I mean, the Beatles were responsible basically for Jim Peterik. I mean, before the Beatles, I was influenced by Elvis Presley and then the Ventures, but not to the degree where I knew I had to do this, you know. And even before the Ed Sullivan Show, I saw a grainy clip on the Jack Parr Show from the BBC, and they're singing She Loves You, and it changed my life. The Beatles were extremely important to me. And when I put together the Ides of March, that was our role model. The first song we ever worked out was Tell Me Why by the Beatles. And, of course, I had my favorites, and within the band, I loved McCartney for his melodies, but I really loved John Lennon for his voice and his image. And I know we're talking about the anniversary of his death, and of course, you know, everybody remembers where they were when John Kennedy was shot. But I think everybody also remembers, at least in the rock world, when they heard about the news of John Lennon. And I was in the living room in my house, and I got a call from a very good friend named James Fares, who gave you the news, and it just, you know, just a shock. You just went numb. You just couldn't even believe it. You couldn't even process it. He was the quirky guy. He was the rebel he was the acid in the sugar, you know, with McCartney being the sugar. And the voice, you know, I didn't know who was singing what when they came out with She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand and I Want You Back, all those songs. But when I went back and listened, I realized the voice I really was attracted to was Lennon. McCartney was sweet, it was great, but Lennon was the guy that got my business and very influential on me.
Well, that's very interesting. And again, Jim, I'll tell you what: if you haven't ever done any interviewing, you should look into at least moonlighting in it, because you anticipated my next question perfectly. I was going to ask you where you were when you found out about this, and again, it just had to be, as you said, such a great shock. Probably took quite a while to get over. What were some of the things that went through your head, really, the next time you either went out on stage, or if that was a period where you were in a studio, or wherever you were when you had to pick up the old instrument again and get back out and perform? What were some of the thoughts going through your head the first time after you had learned the news?
Well, I think, you know, everybody was thinking like me that we were deprived of some great music. It's like when Buddy Holly was killed in the plane crash, died in the plane crash, rather. What music would John Lennon have come up with? It's just a real shame. But also his memory lives on in a good way. And still to this day, when I'm on stage, I think of him. I think of a few people that are like role models, like Bob Seger and Bruce Springsteen, a few others. I actually visualize them when I'm on stage to give it my best shot. And Lennon, sometimes I find myself, you know, bobbing my legs the way he did on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I go, that's John, you know, or singing kind of the way he did, or trying to, and dressing like he did, and he was just very influential.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's many in a generation and perhaps even subsequent generations that really have felt the same way as far as, the influence of that music. It was probably kind of hard to pick between them for a lot of people. Did you have any kind of preference on in any of the solo body of work in the 70s? Would your answers thus far lead us to believe that you were probably the most into Lennon stuff, or is that not necessarily the assumption to make?
Well, you know, I think McCartney had a great record after the Beatles. I really like the Cherries record. But Lennon had more teeth, you know, his stuff had more teeth to it. McCartney started to drift away, get a little too saccharine for me. I mean, I love, maybe I'm amazed. I mean, he had his moments of just incredible stuff. But overall, you know, he needed Lennon to, you know, add the acid to the sugar, you know, and at least Lennon had his moments of softness, you know, with some great love songs, where it seemed McCartney only had his love songs, his silly love songs.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talk about saccharin, and I might be the only person that feels this way, but that Christmas song that McCartney's done in the last couple of years, it just makes me want to stab somebody in the eyeball. I just really loathe it. I can't even tell you how much, you know, that's just me. When he kind of gets into the saccharine mode, it's a little bit much for me, but that's just a personal perspective, I suppose.
No, I can relate to it.
Yeah, we all have guys, I guess, that do that to us, you know. You probably have that as a musician, and, you know, you're probably way too professional to call out anybody on air as doing that or single anybody out. And again, you've had to walk in the shoes of a musician, and I haven't, but I'm sure we all have people that affect us in that way. What's your sense also, as long as we're going here and as long as we're kind of going down this path, people have kind of extrapolated about what they thought the future might have held for John Lennon. I've read some kind of alternate histories in recent days here, people getting into stuff, even in some ways wondering that, you know, might he have done some, you know, hip-hop crossovers, you know, once the new millennium, got going here, maybe some offbeat collaborations. Have you ever thought about that, about what are some of the things you thought he might have gotten into, maybe if there were any clues from Double Fantasy of what direction he was going?
Well, I never really thought about it until just now, Rick. But I think he's an experimenter. I can see him liking the hip hop. I can see him liking the rap. He's an edgy guy, you know. He's experimental. I mean, I can see him getting way out there. So I definitely can see him expanding into that realm.
Yeah, it would have been very interesting, had we gotten the chance to see what directions it might have taken. But I can say this just to kind of segue and kind of bring it full circle. We have, fortunately, over the years, gotten to see all the different directions that you've gone in with your career, with all the different elements of it here as well. I was very struck also, too, when you talk about that different genres, and you talked earlier about your different experiences and everything like that. The experience, I guess it would have been, what, this past fall of backing up the LSU marching band and their final halftime show against Ole Miss. I mean, as far as your eclectic experiences musically, that had to be way up there.
Yeah, that was one of the high points of my career. That was a couple weeks ago, actually, and I was asked to do halftime at the LSU Ole Miss game, and boy, willingly accepted. That same day, I was inducted into the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame. You know, right next to some of my heroes, like, you know, Dr. John, and on and on. So many great heroes. But yeah, the halftime came, and I did Vehicle and Eye of the Tiger with the marching band of LSU, 325 strong, and singing to 93,000 people in the stands and 20 million in the homes watching the game. It was just a major deal.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely got to be one of the biggest crowds you've ever been in front of, and most rabid the way that those people get it going down in Death Valley, no question about it. We always, Jim, love to give our guests a chance to plug anything they got going on here. I know that you've got some very interesting things going on going forward here too, and I believe among other things, a book project as well.
Well, I mean, eventually, I just started working on it, but it's a ways off. It's going to be a perspective on my career, anecdotes and philosophies and, just the journey. Mm-hmm. I'm also producing a wonderful female named Lisa McLowry, who is really making waves at AC and Smooth Jazz. A lot of really good songs that I wrote or co-wrote with her, a tremendous singer. I'm developing new artists, Mallory Lennon, no pun there, but we're both huge Lennon fans, and a few other acts that I'm just nurturing. I'm also writing songs for movies still, of course, and I'm just all over the board. And the Ides of March just put out a brand new album after 47 years of being together. Life is good. Life is interesting.
Oh, that's great. And I'm just curious here. I'm always intrigued by any potential degrees of separation among our guests. We just had on earlier in the show our friend Joe DiAguardi, and of course his daughter Kara, who we've gotten to know a little bit as well too, also pretty prominent in the songwriting biz and as a in different aspects of music. Have you ever at any point in time crossed paths with her or anybody she's worked with?
Only recently, we reached out to her when the new Dummies book came out. We needed someone to write the foreword, and we reached out to Kara, and she wrote a wonderful testimony to the book, and it exists right now in all the bookstores.
Wow. What a coincidence between our guests for tonight. And I know that, Steve wasn't even, you guys just happened to be available the same night. Her father, Joe, who gave it a heck of a run, to be in the Senate this year, and what a wonderful public advocate he is, a good friend of ours. That's a coincidence, yeah, to have you on.
It really is. We were just talking to her, and she was right at the last minute. We needed someone, and she came through. It was fabulous.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Oh, she's outstanding. Yeah, and I think her new show on Bravo's going to do real well. Well, Jim, I have to say, again, it was just a true pleasure to have you on the FDH Lounge tonight. We always love guests who, really they've been proficient in a number of different areas, can talk in a number of different areas. It certainly lived up to that, and then some. Real pleasure for us, sir. We'd love to have you back on anytime.
You too, Rick. And it was a pleasure talking to you, someone so knowledgeable about rock and has such a obvious passion for it.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much, Jim. Jim Peterick, okay. Everybody. What a tremendous career he has had, among other things, the founder and guitarist for Survivor. We're going to take our top of the hour break now, come back on the other side. It's the FDH Lounge Pigskin Report, NFL and college, leading into our college football bowl draft. Original dignitary Nate Noy is going to be back on with us here for that one, here leading into our football at the end of the show. That's about to make me commit an act of violence, I have to say. I cannot tell you how much I loathe that particular piece of music. Everybody, it's too bad we don't have two-way cameras. You should have seen Paul on the other side of the glass once I mentioned the extent to which I hate it. I hate this song. I hate this song more than words could possibly say. So what more can I say than that? We'll come back on the other side, hour three, the FDA Clowns episode number 126, in high definition only on the Sports Talk.